So, Larry, you're going to have a program here on November 2nd, Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum, part of the Art Hop. And I understand it's called Sky Legends of the Three Fires. And there's going to be both music, but you're the storyteller part of this. So tell us a little bit about what this event is.
Well, the Sky Legends of the Three Fires is a planetarium show that I did probably 20 years ago for the planetarium, and they're still running it, making millions, I'm sure. And so they're going to show that as part of the Art Hop. After the planetarium show, I'm going to tell some stories, Native American stories, and interspersed after me will be a Native American drum group from south of Battle Creek, the Nottawasippi Huron Potawatomis. So it will be a nice evening of mixed media and Native American culture. It'll be quite interesting, I think.
What kind of stories are these? How did you find these stories?
I had a tumultuous life, you might say, and in the course of trying to get sober and get away from that outlaw life, I reconnected with my tribe. And when I did that, a lot of things changed. I took on the spirituality and worldview of the Ottawa. I got sober. That was some 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. And like any newcomer to a culture or to a lifestyle,
yeah,
I was very eager to learn about all I had missed during my life. So I learned music, and I learned storytelling. I was a dancer. I was a public speaker. I just threw myself completely into Ottawa culture.
Yeah.
And as part of doing that, I was a part of a Native American drum and dance troupe, and we used to travel throughout the Great Lakes area presenting dance and drumming.
Yeah.
It was funny afterwards. There was about 9 or 10 of us in the group, and we were in a Denny's having some supper. And I had heard a story earlier that month, I assume, or week, whenever it was. And I, as we were eating, I said, well, let me tell a story I heard. And I told the story. And I got a lot of compliments. And people said, wow, you did that well.
It's a talent, yeah, to tell a story well.
More than that, it was a guy, an alcoholic, a longtime alcoholic, and a guy like me didn't get a lot of compliments as alcoholism progressed, of course. Early on, when I was in my 20s, I was the life of the party and quite the happy-go-lucky. But as I got into my 30s and 35 years old, I was losing it.
Yeah.
So I particularly like the idea that people were patting me on the back and saying, well, you did that good. So at that time, I just started listening to stories or looking up stories. There's some famous anthropologists. Dunsmore is a woman who in the late 1800s traveled by canoe recording songs of the natives of the Great Lakes and their stories. Now, as you can imagine, in the 1900s, to record something was quite an event. Lugging
big equipment
and batteries and all that. So I just started getting interested in stories, and of course, the more I got interested, the more stories I had to tell, and I started becoming the spokesperson for our drum and dance group because I do like speaking publicly,
mm-hmm.
and the drummers and singers and dancers liked it when I told a story because they weren't working, so
right.
to speak, so they could take a little break. I'd tell a 5 or a 10 minute story, and then we'd go back to some different dances. And so that's how I got into it. And then it became a true avocation for the last 35 years. I've been collecting and studying and sharing Native American stories. What I really like doing is analyzing stories finding out what is the lesson in here, what is the message, what are they really trying to teach, are they trying to teach anything.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've come to believe that our Native American stories are equal to Scripture, and that we read the same Scriptures over and over all our lives. We know all those stories, but we read them again or we hear them again so that we can make ourselves better people. Well, I think
or just glean something else probably every time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And not every Native American story is filled with spirituality and lessons and teachings. So I search out those ones that are and that do have a message. And and those are the ones I like to share the best.
You have to have a pretty good memory for that, too, I would think. Remember, how many stories are stored away in the back of your mind?
Oh, I got plenty in my mind, complete. The ones that bother me are that I can only, there was a story about how the possum lost all the hair on its tail. And I started out where the possum was following the raccoon because the raccoon had these wonderful stripes and the possum was breaking into the raccoon's home and going through his stuff, trying to find out how do I get these. So anyway, to shorten the story, the possum finally goes to the raccoon and says, I just love those rings on your tail. How do you do it? And the raccoon knew that the possum had been stalking him. And so the raccoon says, well, you get some cloth, and every place you want a stripe, you tie that around your tail. And then you put your tail in the fire, and when you pull it out and take the cloth will burn off, you'll have these beautiful rings. So, of course, the possum did that, and that's why today the possum has a much more intricate part in the middle of it that I can't recall. So anyway, it's, of course, the ones what all storytellers say is if you want to keep a story, you have to constantly give it away.
That's true. Yeah, that's a neat way to think of it. Yeah, I like that. Well, one of the stories you have, the biggest story, is that tumultuous story of your own life. I've been reading Lost from the Ottawa, the story of the journey back, a memoir. So why don't we touch on that a little bit and start with, since we've been talking about your connection to Native American culture, your own ancestry, how you found out?
Well, that is an interesting story. Well, I was, I'll just start at the beginning. I was conceived and born in the Traverse City State Psychiatric Hospital. My father was a patient in the hospital and was a chronic alcoholic, as I understand, suffering from delirious tremens and the very advanced stages of alcoholism.
Yeah.
He was a half-blood Ottawa. My mother was an Ojibwe woman from Canada. So the records on her I'm having a harder time finding. For one thing, I don't speak French. And most of the communications I get from Canada are all in French.
So you're still in the process of digging through your ancestry?
Yeah, I'm not I don't have a lot of stick-to-itiveness, as my adopted mother would say. When things come up, I follow them up, but I'm not much of a searcher. I don't like the computer. I do email, but that's about the extent of my stuff on the computer. So I'm still looking for some of that stuff. And she, unfortunately, had been diagnosed with syphilis. And back in those days, 1940s, the patients at the state hospital, this was in Traverse City, Michigan, would be rented out to the various cherry growers to pick cherries and do work. And as I understand it, my biological mother and father were in that sort of situation and probably stepped away for a moment of privacy. I know I would.
Under the cherry tree, a little bit of romance.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, at 18 months, I was adopted by the Plamundans, who were a Catholic, hardworking, kind of salt-of-the-earth family. My father came from my adopted father came from a family of 14 and farmers up in Lake Leelanau, and just a very wonderful man. I never got along with my mother and had a lot of conflict with her throughout my time with them.
You were a bit of a troublemaker.
I was a bad kid. I was a proverbial bad kid. There was no doubt about it. I also was ADD and ADHD and, according to some diagnosis, oppositional defiant disorder and a lot of those things going on. I never got along with Catholicism.
Yeah.
I did it all. I folded my hands just the right way and said all the prayers, but deep in my heart, I didn't click for me. At 14, I discovered alcohol, and the first time I drank beer, I lifted off the ground about 3 feet. And I, wow, this is the most wonderful thing in the world.
They say it's hereditary, too, no?
Well, certainly through Native Americans. There's somewhat of an explanation for that that was given to me early on in my struggle to get sober. A psychiatrist told me that one of the reasons that Native Americans are so susceptible to alcohol is that, he gave this example, he said, the Jewish people have had alcohol in their culture for centuries and centuries. And when alcohol develops in Jewish folks, it's generally much later in life. Europeans have had alcohol for centuries and centuries, not as long as the Jewish folks. And when they develop alcoholism, it's in middle age. Mm. And Native Americans had never had alcohol in our culture.
Right.
And when we develop alcoholism, it's at a very early age and continues on until generally our death.
So you made this discovery. You're 3 feet off the ground.
Yes. And one of the things I can always remember about that is I couldn't understand why adults weren't drinking all the time. This was such a wonderful feeling. And we laughed and we stumbled and we sang and we had just me and my buddies, you know, other 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds. And it was just a baffling mystery to me why everyone wasn't drinking all the time. Just to illustrate a little bit, I mean, at 14 years old, I was staying out all night. I wasn't coming home. Because my dad had a grocery store that sold beer and wine, and I had purloined a key. And so I was stealing beer from my dad, and, of course, that made me a very popular at 14 years old. The 16-year-old guys who had the cars,
right,
they picked me up, and that was my in to any sort of social life. We lived in the country, so getting into town where the dance was or where the basketball game or anything like that was always a difficult chore. And because of this staying out on, I just refused to obey. I just wouldn't obey. Like any parent, they were on me. You can't stay out on it. I thought you were in the ditch, Dad, and all that sort of thing.
That
all parents.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I'd say, oh, okay, and then I'd skip school and I wouldn't come home for a day or two.
Yeah.
So at 15, I was taken to court and the judge declared me incorrigible. And I was sent to a Catholic reform school in Terre Haute, Indiana. And I have nothing really good to say about that place. It was, it's closed. I say that, it's closed. So I was there for a year. When I got out of reform school at 16, I went back to Traverse City, and I quickly ran away. Within a week or two of being home, I ran away. And lived around Traverse City for the summer. When the weather started getting cold, I hitchhiked south. I hitchhiked all the way to Florida, and at that time, probably 63, 64, I was 17, 18 years old.
Yeah.
I wasn't part of the civil rights movement, but I witnessed the movement, and that had a real strong effect on me.
Sure.
I can remember going into a Sinclair gas station. And outside of the gas station, this was in Georgia or someplace in the South, outside of the gas station was a regular porcelain drinking fountain with a sign over it, White's. And next to it was a garden hose with a sign over it, Black's or Coloreds or whatever.
Yeah.
Similar with the outhouse. There was an outhouse for the Black folks and a toilet, inside toilet or bathroom for the Whites. And I had no political consciousness or inclination, but this just seemed wrong to me. I was offended.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was living at, I always thought I was a white kid. Well, I kind of told a fib there. When I was 16 and got out of reform school and was staying at home for a while, my parents again took me to social workers. I'd been to social workers and child psychologists and all this
stuff. They kept trying.
Yes, they did. I have to give them that. So they took me to a social worker again and said that I was still acting up and I was even less controllable. And I was bigger now. I was, you know, 125 pounds and my mom wasn't. The social worker said, well, maybe if he knew of his heritage, that this would help him. So I can remember, I still have the letter. It's a one-page letter. And the half, top half is about my dad. My dad's name was Lewis Akins. He was honorably...
The biological father,
right, my,
yeah.
My biological mm-hmm. father. He was honorably discharged from World War One. He was in World War One, honorably discharged. He was a heavy equipment operator in the lumber industry. So that was all they had about... Oh, and I went to the eighth grade. My mother, my biological mother, was... a naturalized American citizen. She had been naturalized at the age of 9 when her Ojibwe family moved to Manistee.
Mm-hmm.
She had finished high school and she worked as a telephone operator, a long distance in those days when they'd say, number please. And so that was supposed to solve my problem, these...
A sense of belonging.
Couple senses.
Yeah.
Even at that age, at 16, I knew that being Indian didn't mean anything unless you knew your tribe. Like if you go to Native people and say, well, I'm Native. The first thing out of their mouth is, well, what tribe?
Right.
Very excited,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So growing up, I never claimed to be a Native person. I just felt, plus I was mixed blood and in my own little mind, I didn't feel I was worthy or any of those sort of things that people with low self-esteem might find. So I just bummed around the country for hitchhiking all up and down the East Coast. My motivation was to be a beatnik.
On the Road, Kerouac's
book. Yeah, that book really, really powerfully moved me. Because these were the kind of people that I might not know them, but I wanted to know these kind of people.
Yeah.
You know. So... I spent a lot of time in Greenwich Village in New York. I went up to Hartford. There was a little enclave of beatniks up there. And I went down to Richmond, Virginia. There were some, believe it or not, some progressive people down there. And I had no talents or apparent talents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just made myself useful. I'll kind of scope out the situation, see what's going on. Okay, yeah.
That was one of your talents.
You were
pretty resourceful.
That was a survival skill that I think one develops when you're living on the street at 16, you know. Well, you see where the power lies, and that's where you got
to... Find a way to make yourself useful.
Yeah. So I can remember I was 20 years old because I turned 21 when I was working for the AFL-CIO as a union organizer. Now, we must understand that throughout all this, alcohol is there all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end of my alcoholism, when I was, as we say, hitting bottom, we have a saying in the 12-step group that I'm in that I didn't get in trouble every time I drank, but every time I was in trouble, I had been drinking.
True enough,
so that was... So I was working for the union. I had a cousin... an adopted cousin who was married to a fellow who was working for the AFL-CIO as union organizers of migrant workers. You couldn't possibly be old enough to remember the grape strike and the lettuce strike. But there was a great movement with Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers, primarily in the Imperial Valley and San Joaquin Valley of California and Texas. And the AFL-CIO decided that they would let Caesar, the United Farm Workers, organize everything west of the Mississippi, and the AFL-CIO would organize all the migrant workers east of the Mississippi. And in the wisdom of the union, they knew that it wouldn't do to bring on some United Auto Workers organizers with big lapels and smoking cigars and talking out of the side of their mouth and stuff. And the union was also astute enough to recognize that with there was a young movement developing in John Kennedy, remember, in the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
And all these young people were motivated and had high ideals and consciousness. And so they said, well, let's get some of these young idealistics to work for nothing or next to nothing. Actually, it was, for a guy like me, it was a lot of money. They gave me a car and $155 a week, and they paid for the hotels.
Well, back then especially,
that was big money. I couldn't believe it, which was part of my downfall.
Uh-oh.
Money.
Yeah.
So anyway, we started in Traverse City organizing cherry workers, and we went to the Saginaw Valley for the beet and pickle pickers. Then we went on down to Ohio to the tomato pickers in Kokomo, Indiana for tomato pickers, and then on to Florida for orange and avocado pickers and tomato pickers. And it was exciting. I didn't know anything. And we'd just pull, we'd see a bunch of pickers out in the field. We'd pull the car out and walk out in the field. And if they were Hispanic, we'd say, habla inglés. And they'd say, no habla inglés. But they'd point to the guy who habla inglés.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'd go organize him, and he would organize the workers.
Okay.
And working for the union really was a turning point in my life. I think it saved my life, and I'll tell you why. Up until this point, I was a mean man, angry, always angry.
Yeah.
Didn't like to be around success, unless it were my friends.
Yeah.
But people driving nice cars, wearing nice clothes, I didn't like them. I just didn't like them.
Yeah.
I was angry. So when I started working with these union guys, these other young men who are all college educated or going to college at least, they started talking about Marxism and classes and the ruling class and the working class and the power structure and all these things. And that saved my life because now I didn't have to hate everybody. All I had to hate was the ruling class. This is easy. So that really did change me, and I started reading, and I started, I can remember just I don't know if this is powerful for anyone else, but it was real powerful for me. We used to pay our bills with American Express. The union gave us American Express cards, and we all had one. And we were just sitting around one day, and this guy from Arkansas, a young organizer, we're all in our 20s.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, we shouldn't be using this American Express card. I say, why? He said, well, because they have stock in South Africa and apartheid. I said, well, what's apartheid? And he told me. And he said, wow, man, this dude's just as old as I am, but he's got all this information about Marx and Lenin and Trotsky and all the others and Kwame Nkrumah in Africa, and he just was full of this information, and I worked with him. We'd always work in teams, so we rode in the car together and did all this. And I just loved it. I just felt like I was really seeing something true and honest for the first time. Of course, then I got into the Cuban Revolution and read about Che and Fidel and all the romanticism of that, you know, living in the mountains and growing beards and it just all fascinated me, and that's kind of where I'm still at today.
At some point, you end up on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, and looking into your book and your bio, you're a little proud of that. How did that happen?
Well, I'm very proud of it.
How did you get on this list?
Well, I'll tell you. In 1967, I was hitchhiking with a young woman. We were in the UP and we were going to Florida. And we got a ride outside of Flint, and the guy took us to Detroit, and he dropped us off at the Greyhound bus station in downtown Detroit. And it was quite a scene, actually. It was full of people, and there were all these young people with army fatigue jackets with flowers sewn on them, and young women with long hair and bell bottoms and a lot of flowers and wearing beads. I had never seen or heard anything about no hippies, but they were definitely there in the thousands, not just in the bus station, but I mean all around Detroit.
Yeah.
At the same time, the bus station was full of military guys, sailors and soldiers dragging their duffel bags around and getting shipped off. And wow, it was just quite a picture there. Well, Debbie and I fell in with a group of young people who had flowers in their hair and stuff. And, hey, what's going on? And people started talking about Plum Street, which was, turned out to be a young, a very small hippie enclave, kind of like the Haight-Ashbury was supposed to be in California. There were boutiques and a couple restaurants and there was a Greek grocery store and a record store and a leather maker and various things. So we went to down to Plum Street and went into the, one of these boutiques and got talking with the guy who owned the boutique. And he said, what I really need is a leather worker, a sandal maker. He said, we could clean up. And I previously, when I had a year or so earlier, when I had been in Greenwich Village, there was this little storefront in the village with the name of Sandals by David. And he had his workbench set up right in the front display window. So you could stand on the sidewalk and watch this guy make sandals. So every day, or often, quite often, I'd get my pizza was 10 cents a slice in those days. I'd get my little 10-cent slice of pizza and go and stand in front of the sandal store and watch this guy make sandals. So when I'm in Detroit a year or so later and the guy's in the boutique, his head shop, whatever we want to call it, I need a sandal maker or a leather worker. I said, well, I can do that.
See, that's what I mean about resourceful.
Well, but without...
You just jump right in.
Without at least watching,
you
wouldn't have a clue, but it's quite simple, really. You trace the person's foot, cut out the leather.
Yeah.
Quite easy. But yes, you do have to have the whatever it might be to actually do it.
Right.
But I do that all the time. We were talking earlier about my writing here for WMUK and Tony Griffith. That was his name. He was a news director. But he used to work with me, and we would go tooth and nail because I don't want anyone to edit my stuff. And he'd say, you got 7 minutes. Oh, no. This is 13 minutes, man, and if you take one part out, it's just not going
to
work.
I hate to tell you something here, Larry.
I had to accept it. Yeah, I mean, it's his radio station.
Right.
But I didn't give up without it.
Yeah.
So anyway, we were in Detroit. The young woman, she continued hitchhiking on to Florida. I stayed in Detroit, and I fell in with a group of people called the Detroit Artist Workshop, which was founded by John Sinclair. And it was made up of filmmakers and poets and musicians and weirdos of every description. And that was another example of you look around, you see what needs to be done, you see who's in charge or who is the brightest light. And I gravitated to them, and it happened to be John Sinclair, and he was publishing a book, self-publishing a book, not on a computer, but... Mm-hmm. Actually printing pages and then collating pages and putting it. And so we, I just fell into line walking around the table with them collating these pages and became fast friends. Many of the listeners will know that John Sinclair was very significant in the decriminalization of marijuana. He had been sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in prison for giving 2 marijuana cigarettes to an undercover Detroit police officer. Before he went to prison, I had got arrested in Traverse City for the same thing. I was charged with sale and or distribution of marijuana. It's important to note that at that time in Michigan, simple possession of a marijuana cigarette was a minimum of 10 years and a maximum of 20 years in prison. Sale and or distribution, as I was charged with, was 20 to life. So when I finally got out of jail, out of Grand Traverse County Jail, I hooked up with Sinclair and said, man, we ought to do something about this because we're going to end up in prison for a long time. And he said, what do you think we should do? Now, for a long time, I had been following the anti-war movement and was part of the anti-war movement in America. And I knew about SDS, and I knew about Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and I knew about the Black Panthers. And living in Detroit, there was a lot of black nationalist organizations. There was a Republican New Africa. There was just a lot of politics going on. So I told Sinclair, I said, well, I think we ought to form a political organization so we can move as a unified group with an ideology and some sort of thought to this. And he said, well, check it out. So I did. And I looked very closely at the Black Panther Party, and they really impressed me because they were taking junkies and pimps and the hardcore street people, and they were giving them discipline. They were dressing them up. They're all standing tall, and they're all with their shoulders back. I say, man, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the Nation of Islam because there's the same situation. I read Malcolm X's book, the same situation, taking these lowlifes, bringing them up, cleaning them up, straightening them up. When you meet them on the street, black or white, they were polite to me. They were nice. I'd always buy their newspaper. And just gentlemen. There's no other way to say it. Wow, that's pretty cool. I went to some SDS meetings, and that to me just seemed to be a student debating society. I mean, I can remember being in one debate where we spent hours, literally hours, debating whether the working class should be called the working class or should they be called the proletariat. And it was like all these freshmen who learned something and they just had to write a paper on it. And it was so, although they were friends of mine, we were of the same culture. We smoked pot. We listened to rock and roll. We, you know, liked to go to the beach. Their politics just wasn't for me. So anyway, I like to think that we formed an organization called the White Panther Party, and we picked that name particularly because we the very opening statement of our 10-point program was complete support for the Black Panther Party. We felt they were the vanguard of the whatever revolution we were going to make, and we wanted it clear that we were in support of them. So when we formed the White Panther Party, we primarily focused our attention on high school kids and college kids, and we were quite successful. You can tell by the resistance we got from the principals and the superintendents and the power structure to
Which is how you measure your
That's
success.
That's how I measure success. Who are your enemies?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why I'm proud of this part of the story we're going to tell. So the movement was going on, anti-war demonstrations. You might recall there were bombings, the Weathermen, Symbionese Liberation Army, all sorts of weirdness was coming up to the top. In September of 1968, unknown person or persons planted a dynamite bomb at a clandestine CIA office in Ann Arbor. No one was hurt. Actually, little damage was done.
Mm-hmm.
About a year later, they ensconced a secret grand jury. And in a year later, in 1969 of October, I was indicted for doing the bombing, and John Sinclair was indicted as a co-conspirator. Well, Sinclair was already in the penitentiary doing his 9.5 to 10 year sentence on his possession of marijuana charge. Mm-hmm. I heard it on the radio. I was in the basement of our headquarters printing some leaflets and flyers. The printer jammed, and I turned it off real quick and always had the radio on anyway, and there was a news report that I had been indicted. My wife came bounding down the stairs, and she said, the Michigan Daily just called, and they want a statement on this indictment. And I said, I got to get out of here. I thought that the FBI had already surrounded the house and were about to jump on us with both feet. But I got out of the house. I was taken up north to a Hare Krishna ashram where I held out for 2 nights. And then I was taken to not the Cincinnati airport. It's across the river in Kentucky to the airport and flew to San Francisco and then started my underground odyssey. I was quickly placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, hid out in Northern California for several months, made my way to Buffalo, then on to Toronto, then on to Scandinavia. In Toronto, I got a Canadian passport from some Quebecois, those stubborn French-speaking Canadians who want to separate French-speaking Canada from English-speaking. They were quite revolutionary at the time. They gave me a passport, and I ended up in Algiers.
Yeah.
And got political asylum. But as I often say, there weren't any hippie girls in Algeria. There wasn't any reefer. There wasn't any rock and roll. And
so
I was
got
lonesome. And they frowned on drinking, which put me at a disadvantage. So after 2 weeks in Algeria, I came home. A short time later, I was captured. And then we went to trial on the CIA case. During our trial in Detroit, we filed a motion asking the government if there were any electronic surveillance, any wiretaps, any satellite camera, anything.
Right.
And this is a common question that was asked during all of the political trials of the 60s and 70s. It's just a standard question. Mm-hmm. And in each time, the government would stand up and say, why, no, we don't wiretap anyone. That would be wrong. In our case, for some reason, they stood up and said, yes, we have wiretaps of Mr. Plamondon. And immediately our attorney said, I might mention our attorneys, William Kunstler, Leonard Weinglass, and Buck Davis, three famous movement attorneys, were part of the Chicago 7 trial and AIM trial, American Indian Movement trials. So they had plenty credentials. Immediately they said, well, where's the warrant for this wiretap? And the government said, well, we don't need a warrant because Mr. Plamondon is a threat to national security. And our judge, Judge Damon Keith, in that time there were 1,500 federal judges in America, and there were only five that were black. And we got Judge Damon Keith, a black civil rights activist. And Judge Keith, in his famous opinion, said, in my court, the Fourth Amendment still means something. So the government appealed to the Court of Appeals, where we won a three-judge panel in the Court of Appeals, and finally went to the U.S. Supreme Court, where we won a unanimous decision in our behalf, which ultimately meant that citizens cannot be wiretapped just because the president says so. That's what the argument came to. The president can decide who is a threat and who is not. So George Bush, of course, erased all those advances with his Patriot Act, and the Supreme Court has cemented all this. But at the time, it was a pretty big deal. And we'll close this part of the story with this little anecdote. We have to give a lot of dates, but they're important. You might recall that when the Supreme Court hears a case in February, they will release their decision in June. And that's what happened in our case. They heard oral arguments in February. And in June, June 17th, which was a Friday, they were set to release their opinion. For some strange and unknown reason, a very uncommon event happened, and that's that they decided that they would not release their opinion on Friday. However, they would wait until Monday to release their opinion. The Watergate break-in happened June 17th, Friday. Wait, do I have that wrong? It can't be, because it was Saturday. So the Watergate break-in must have happened on the 20th. The real point is that the Supreme Court notified the Nixon White House that Nixon lost the wiretap issue, and that on Monday, every wiretap without a warrant is going to be illegal. And that's why the plumbers went into the Watergate, is to remove those listening devices. So I always close by saying, I've never admitted or denied doing that bombing. I don't think anyone would believe me no matter what I said. If I said I didn't do it, I don't think people would believe me. And if I said I did do it, my friends would just think I'm bragging. So I never go either way. But whoever did, set the planets in motion that ultimately collided that brought down Richard Nixon and his administration.
I know that's just one of many, many stories.
Yeah.
People can always tap into this book, Lost from the Ottawa.
It's on Amazon as well as it can be ordered. It's not in stock at local bookstores, but they can order it.